This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 3 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up in today's programme, Martin McGuinness, the former Sinn Féin Deputy First Minister and ex-IRA leader, passed away last night following a short illness. But what has his legacy been to the Anglo-Irish peace process, and what will be his place in Irish history? Tensions between the US and its European allies have come under more strain after US President Donald Trump singled out Germany and other European NATO members who he believes are not paying their way within the military alliance. But what damage is the US President doing to relations within NATO, and is he right to demand they pay more? The five main contenders in the French presidential elections battled it out last night in a live televised debate. Centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron seemed to come out on top. We'll be taking a look at what to expect over the final few weeks of campaigning. A former British ambassador to the US has warned American President Donald Trump is undermining US and UK intelligence efforts by making claims that British intelligence has been bugging Trump's offices. But will the row have lasting damage on joint intelligence working, and has President Trump got reasonable grounds to believe intelligence services have placed him under surveillance? Free trade talks between the European Union and the US are in a deep freeze, the EU Trade Commissioner Cecilia Malmström said last night in Toronto. So what does the future hold for the controversial transatlantic trade and investment partnership? And we've brought you some silly stories in the past about obscene amounts of money spent on food. And guess what? We have another one for you at the end of the show. All of that and more over the next hour on this Tuesday edition of World in Focus. He was once the leading face of the Irish Republican Army, one of the foremost and most deadly guerrilla organisations in modern times. But Martin McGuinness's transition from gunman to Deputy First Minister is, by any measure, remarkable. Last night, the 66-year-old Irish Republican died following a short illness. Our reporter Mark Hurst has been looking back at his legacy.
Few individuals symbolise the transition from war to peace more than former IRA leader and Sinn Féin Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness. Last night, aged just 66, the iconic Irish Republican passed away as a result of a rare heart condition. He leaves behind a family, a community, and an entire movement in mourning. In the UK, he was despised as a terrorist, but for many in Ireland, and ultimately many of his former enemies, he has been lauded as one of the key figures in persuading the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, to turn its back on nearly four decades of armed struggle and follow an exclusively peaceful path to peace. McGuinness grew up in Derry, an iconic Republican city that, despite having a population that was 95% nationalist, was ruled by an apartheid pro-British minority of unionists. By the age of 21, McGuinness was second in command of the Derry IRA. A few years later, he was described by one British Royal Marine colonel as, quotes, excellent officer material, and played a crucial and strategically important role in reorganising the IRA in the late 1970s into one of the most effective guerrilla organisations of modern times. But it will be McGuinness's legacy and commitment to peace that he will be ultimately remembered for. Along with Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams, McGuinness persuaded the Army Council, the governing body of the IRA, to move away from armed conflict and seek exclusively peaceful means to achieve their goal of a united Ireland. In 2005, the IRA formally announced it had ended its campaign and ordered all of its volunteers to stand down. It was a historic moment that marked the end of a conflict that had claimed over 3,500 lives and wounded more than 47,500 people. As part of the power-sharing executive at Stormont, McGuinness matched his talent as a military strategist and quickly drew respect from supporters and opponents alike for his ability as a minister within the devolved assembly. Alongside Ian Paisley, the messianic and iconic vocal face of unionism, McGuinness quickly sought to use his skills to break down many of the inequalities and discrimination that had once characterised the British province of Northern Ireland. But in December last year, it became evident McGuinness's health was failing, and ultimately the Sinn Féin Deputy First Minister was forced to stand down. In January, I spoke to Danny Morrison, a close friend of McGuinness and former IRA comrade. Morrison was at pains to make clear that McGuinness's failing health was not the reason for his resignation as Deputy First Minister, but had coincided with a breakdown in trust between Sinn Féin and their power-sharing partners in the Democratic Unionist Party.
The first sign that the general public, including the Republican base, had notice of Martin's illness was when he had to cancel a joint trip with the First Minister, Arlene Foster, to China about a week or two before that. But things, I mean, as you know, things escalated very, very quickly over the Christmas period with certain decisions that the DUP took, including insulting the Irish language community here. We had a situation where a unionist minister gave £200,000 to loyalist bands for new instruments. He refurbished Orange Hall, mostly Orange Halls, to the tune of £180,000. And then he withdrew £50,000 for young children whose parents couldn't afford to send them to the Gaeltacht, which is an Irish language speaking area in Donegal in the summertime. And it was that final insult that precipitated that image you saw on television of a very, very ill, almost whispering Martin McGuinness declare his resignation that month.
And he's been a prominent figure across Irish politics for more than four decades. And in terms of his legacy, he's never shied away from his past membership of the IRA, and he played a prominent role in the 1970s. Given that role, how significant a factor was he in persuading the IRA to pursue the long path to peace?
Well, he was crucial. It was because of his integrity and because he was such a formidable Republican leader whom I met. The first time I met was maybe 45 years ago. After I had come out of prison, I was interned as a teenager. I became editor of Republican News and first met Martin. We met at a time whenever the IRA had been involved in a fairly disastrous ceasefire, which lasted for almost a year. Republicans seemed to lose their way. The Republican leadership was telling us young people on the ground that the British government was going to withdraw, and they were withdrawing key industries as part of an economic withdrawal. But it wasn't the case. Actually, the British government were consolidating their position, and as that year, they were actually building the H-blocks on the same ground as Long Cash internment camp. Uh-huh. And of course, we know that that was to... They were preparing to attempt to criminalise the prisoners, strip them of their clothes, place them in solitary confinement, beat them. And that eventually, of course, led to the 1981 hunger strike when Bobby Sands and then his comrades died. So Martin and I go back to that time. He, of course, himself grew up in Derry, in the Bogside, nine children in a two-bedroom house, outside toilet, no prospects of employment. And he witnessed that famous march on the 5th of October 1968, when the world learnt for the first time exactly what our community had been experiencing for 50 years. And that was because a camera, an actual RTE, an Irish film crew were there when the RUC baton charged a civil rights march. Simply, people were asking for a vote on the right to housing. So that was his, you know, that's where he was born into Irish republicanism. And later, in the summer of 1969, again, the police broke into houses in the Bogside area. The Bogside's a little ghetto built on a swamp on the west bank of the Foyle River. They broke into a house and they beat in front of his children a man called Sammy Devaney to death. And that was the reason why a few weeks later, when the RUC attempted to invade the Bogside again, that the young people declared Free Derry. They hoisted the Irish national flag, the tricolour, above Rossville Flats, and they fought the police for 3 to 4 days. I myself was involved in Belfast at that stage, and in retaliation for the resistance in Derry, the Northern Ireland forces of the Northern Ireland government, the police and a paramilitary group, the Beast Specials, invaded our areas, burnt thousands of people out of their homes, and killed people, shot dead people. And this is before we ever heard of the provisional IRA. So all of the early violence, the early killings of civilians, in fact, the first soldier to be killed was a Catholic Home on Leave from the British Army who was defending the Falls Road. He was shot dead by the police. And the first policeman to be killed was killed by loyalist paramilitaries. The first journalist to be killed was killed by the British Army. And it wasn't until many of these killings had taken place that the Republicans and the IRA came back on the scene again and began to reorganise, initially to defend nationalist ghetto areas, but then to go on to lodge a rage and armed struggle when politics failed here. And that lasted, as you know, for like maybe 30 years.
And one of the most remarkable aspects of his political leadership was when he took office alongside the late Ian Paisley, the Democratic Unionist Party leader. Beyond the politics, these two previously staunch political opponents appear to have formed a genuine friendship and mutual respect of each other, despite being huge figures in their own respective and opposing communities. Would it be fair to describe that relationship as a metaphor for the kind of society you and Martin McGuinness would ultimately like to see achieved in the north of Ireland?
Well, it was totally remarkable and unprecedented. My views of Ian Paisley go back to childhood, whenever he was seen as an ogre, who was responsible for a lot of the early violence and the demonization of the Catholic stroke nationalist community. And yet they forged this incredible friendship, and it was a genuine friendship. Even when Ian Paisley was sick, I was listening to Ian Paisley's wife on BBC Radio Today, and she was telling the interviewer that when Ian Paisley was ill and in hospital, Martin McGuinness visited him, telephoned the house, asked after him, came to the house and visited him. And they did forge a very, very strong relationship. Now, it was not liked by other members of Paisley's party, the DUP. Paisley actually was very, very bitter. He was overthrown because of his friendship with Martin McGuinness. And subsequent leaders have proved to be a major disappointment, including the current leader, Arlene Foster.
Former IRA volunteer Danny Morrison there. One other man who met McGuinness was Colin Parry. In 1993, Colin's 12-year-old son, Tim, was killed in a double bombing carried out by the IRA. Last month, I spoke to Colin Parry about his impressions and relationship with Martin McGuinness, a man who once led the very organisation responsible for his son's death. Colin Parry's first meeting with McGuinness took place in Warrington, the town targeted by the IRA in 1993.
What happened was, after the invitation was issued, Martin McGuinness's office called me direct, said who they were, and said, Martin's been invited to Warrington to attend with his Minister for Education, Hathorn. He's told us he will only attend if you and your wife are happy that he comes. If you don't want him to come, he won't come. So I chatted to Wendy. I said, I'm all for him coming. She was a bit more ambivalent, but in the end said, OK. So I called them back and said, yeah. And one proviso, and they said, what's that? I said that he meets us privately. He doesn't just come to the concert and sit and listen to children singing and then get in the next plane home. He meets us, and he meets us for a serious conversation. And they said, we'll get back to you. And they got back to us, and they said, yes, he's happy to do that. So once he got to Warrington, we met, say we, myself, my wife, the parents of Jonathan Ball, who was the other little boy who died. The four of us met him, Martin, in the town hall. Better part of an hour with him. And I have to say, from that first meeting through several meetings since, I found him a very easy man to talk to. I almost didn't want him to be. It would have been rather neater for him to fit the stereotype, perhaps, of being some green-eyed monster who was a homicidal killer. But, of course, he's not remotely like that. He's a very mildly spoken, calm guy who listens as much as he talks, unlike many politicians.
Few individuals epitomise the transformation from revolutionary to statesman quite like Martin McGuinness. But when the final account of this last few decades of Ireland's history is written, Martin McGuinness's place as peacemaker will be assured. Mark Hurst, World in Focus.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, tensions between the US and its European allies have come under more strain after the US President Donald Trump singled out Germany and other European NATO members who he believes are not paying their way within the military alliance. But what damage is the US President doing to relations within NATO, and is he right to demand they pay more? We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, tensions between the US and its European allies have come under more strain after US President Donald Trump singled out Germany and other European NATO members who he believes are not paying their way within the military alliance. But what damage is the US President doing to relations within NATO, and is he right to demand they pay more? The five main contenders in the French elections battled it out last night in a live televised debate. The centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron seemed to come out on top, and we'll be taking a closer look at what to expect over the final few weeks of campaigning. A former British ambassador to the US has warned American President Donald Trump is undermining US and UK intelligence efforts by making claims British intelligence had been bugging Trump's offices. But will the row have lasting damage on joint intelligence working, and has President Trump got reasonable grounds to believe intelligence services have placed him under surveillance? And we've brought you some silly stories in the past about obscene amounts of money spent on food, and we have another one for you at the end of the show. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 17 minutes past the hour. Are European members of NATO paying their way? The newly elected US President Donald Trump doesn't seem to think so, and he has let his European military allies in NATO know that in no uncertain terms. Our reporter Mark Hurst has been examining whether the row over military spending targets among NATO members will lead to permanent damage.
There are growing signs that relations between European NATO members and their US allies is growing ever more strained. In a tweet, US President Donald Trump said Germany owes vast sums of money to NATO, and the United States must be paid more for the powerful and very expensive defence it provides to Germany. This prompted German Defence Minister Ursula von der Leyen to issue a statement strongly denying the US President's claim, adding that Germany had no debt owed to NATO. Trump has been pressing hard for NATO members to commit to defence spending of 2% of GDP. But last year, only two countries, Greece and Estonia, met the NATO guideline figure on military expenditure. So why are most European NATO members unable to meet the target, and how does that affect the alliance in terms of carrying out its remit? Well, earlier I spoke with Ian Shields of Anglia Ruskin University. Mr. Shields is an associate lecturer in international relations.
There has been quite a bit of focus on this 2% of GDP figure that NATO members should spend as part of their defence commitments. Not all NATO members have achieved that target, but are there genuine economic and domestic political reasons for that?
I would answer yes to both of those questions at one level. Genuine economic reasons, absolutely. If one looks at some of the, for example, southern European countries, that the countries bordering the Mediterranean, and the financial strains that places such as Greece and Italy are under, it's hardly surprising that they put their priorities in a different area. Politically, also, one has to balance the mandate of individual interest versus a wider collective security. And with the rise of populism, as we're seeing across Europe, notwithstanding the outcome of the Dutch election, again, that is hardly surprising. And yet, at the same time, one also has perhaps to suggest that politicians need to take a slightly bigger picture and do something that generally politicians and democracies are not good at, which is taking a very long-term view. And one looks at the successes that NATO has brought in terms of peace, and in pure hard economic terms, in terms of things like peace dividend, and more importantly, in terms of arms sales, then the case for spending that 2% perhaps becomes slightly more pressing. And as ever, it will be a balance that individual governments, individual political parties will look towards.
What practical effect does the shortfall in military spending have on the capability of NATO?
In purely practical terms, it means that NATO is far less able to withstand to large-scale aggression, which I'd be the first to admit is highly unlikely. But more importantly, it has significant shortfalls in its ability to maintain presence over a long period of time. If one just thinks about peacekeeping missions around the world, Cyprus has been going on for a lifetime. And the strain of constantly having to keep that degree of support going needs a robust and in-depth military capability. Even Britain's army was pretty much worn out by the end of Iraq and Afghanistan, let alone peacekeeping missions. And then the final portion where NATO falls down is in pure logistics. Ships, aircraft, and a lot of time underutilized. Without the robust defense spending, these critical areas that allows NATO to operate not only within its area but also out of area just simply are not there.
What stresses will President Trump's robust language about other NATO members put on the alliance? And is there any indication the rest of NATO are making provisions for even a partial withdrawal of support from NATO?
Answer the first part of your question slightly obliquely, and question to what extent is Europe actually responding at all to Trump rhetoric, and also whether this is just pure rhetoric. We're only, 100 or so days into the presidency. It's probably still a little too early to tell exactly how far this is going to be carried through, and it would seem that increasingly he has domestic pressures which are going to force him to look inwards. So I would caution about reading too much into this. Are there any suggestions that any individual European countries are seeking to withdraw from NATO? If you'd asked me that question a month ago, I'd almost have laughed and said absolutely not. And yet I look particularly down to NATO's southeastern flank, and events that are unfolding in Turkey and Turkey's increasing closeness with Russia. And part of me worries, and I mean worries as in staying awake at night worrying, whether we could see Turkey, for different political and economic reasons, threatened to withdraw from NATO. But even those countries on Europe's southern flank I've talked about already who have got financial pressures, such as Greece and Italy, no, I do not foresee for one moment that they would consider withdrawing from NATO, let alone the larger economic powers of Northern Europe, such as Germany or France.
Do you think President Trump's perception of the usefulness or otherwise of NATO is coloured by his focus on the need for a broader international coalition to fight Daesh?
I think he will try to use that as part of pressure to increase defence spending within Europe and to bring NATO closer together. And of course there are other pressures within the alliance, such as the future direction of the EU and whether that should develop its own security arm or whether that is just duplication of the NATO effort. And with Britain looking to exit the European Union, that those are further complications there. But in terms of President Trump seeking to use NATO in a more forward-leaning role to tackle problems, for example, in the Middle East, I think he would struggle to persuade NATO to do so, especially when the Eastern European NATO nations, the Baltic states, Poland, will be looking very much to with trepidation, an increasing trepidation, towards a resurgent Russia.
Ian Shields, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus. That was Ian Shields there of Anglia Ruskin University, an associate lecturer in international relations. Mark Hurst, World in Focus.
This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 24 minutes past the hour. Last night, the five main contenders in the French presidential elections took part in a live televised debate. All eyes were on the far-right Front National candidate Marine Le Pen and the centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron, who are expected to pass through the first round of voting. Also in the running is the left-wing candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the socialist Benoît Hamon, and the right-wing Republican candidate François Fillon. The vote on the left is split between Mélenchon and Hamon, with Hamon struggling to shake off the legacy of the current president François Hollande. François Fillon entered the campaign as a frontrunner, but weeks of scandal surrounding payments made to his family members from public funds for jobs which they may not have actually carried out, resulting in a formal investigation, has resulted in a major hit to his support. While polling now suggests that Le Pen and Macron will make it through the first round of voting, which places the two top candidates head-to-head in the second round, some polling also suggests that up to 4 in 10 voters are still undecided, leaving a lot still to play for. Joining me on the line is Professor Alistair Cole, Professor of European Politics at the Institute of Political Studies in Lyon. Thank you for joining me today, Professor Cole. Now, most people are saying that Emmanuel Macron came out on top in last night's debate. Would you agree with that?
I think it's a difficult one to call. Macron certainly did well. He had the most to lose, of course. To some extent, everybody was out to get him, and he had to defend his position well. I think he did well. He came across as, in a way, a synthesis figure, agreeing with his adversaries. I mean, even Marine Le Pen on occasion. So I think what could have been a very delicate exercise, he came across quite well.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at some of the issues raised during the debate, there was, of course, a discussion about religion, specifically the France's Muslim community, and the candidates reiterated their own messages, though was this discussion not fairly predictable? Did any of the candidates really say anything new on the topic?
No, I think to some extent this was the occasion where Marine Le Pen, for example, clearly set out her stance on Islam, on the role of Muslims in French society, on the difficulties of integration, and her particular stance on that, of course. It was interesting, the question on laïcité, which is clearly the French lay secular tradition, which in a way was interpreted very differently by the candidates, but it certainly allowed it allowed Marine Le Pen to state her view, and it also allowed the socialist Benoît Hamon to give in the French context, a multicultural response favourable to diversity.
And of course, Mélenchon, I believe, took the opportunity to point out that there were many atheists in France and that the discussion should be moved away from religion.
Indeed. And in a way, Mélenchon, who I thought came out very well in this debate, mainly because he's got nothing to lose and he's not going to get elected, but he did come across very well. Mélenchon clearly made the point that France has a very strong secular tradition, that debating religion endlessly in the public sphere is not to everybody's taste, and clearly most electors of Jean-Luc Mélenchon would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, my French wasn't good enough to follow the debate live, though reading transcripts, it does seem like Mélenchon landed a few good blows to Le Pen during the debate. However, at the moment, is it not more likely that the blows he lands on Le Pen are just going to encourage voters to go from Le Pen to Macron rather than from anybody to Mélenchon?
I think in a way what's happening here is you very clearly have two candidates on the left, Mélenchon and Benoît Hamon, the socialist, who are almost neck and neck between sort of 11 and 14% each of them. Were there to be only one candidate on the left, then the left candidate would have a good chance of getting to the second round. However, what's going on there? There's clearly a battle going on for leadership of that left position. And I think in a way, obviously Macron and Marine Le Pen are quite happy with that, and probably even Fillon is quite happy with that, because it excludes the left. So I think really the real battleground going on there was between Macron and Marine Le Pen. And you could see the tension, you could hear the tension between the two in those exchanges. So I think that's where the real battle lines are being drawn.
And for Macron to cement his first round victory, to achieve that, what key messages are we likely to see from him campaigning in the final weeks?
I think what's going to be interesting here is that Macron realizes that to some extent he's in a favorable position on the first round. So he needs to continue to fight what I would call a second round battle, really, until the second round. And that is, he needs to appear to be ecumenical. He needs to appear to stress synthesis, to bring in good ideas from the left and the right. He needs to appear to be quite tolerant. Now, of course, that's difficult in the Russian ready of a presidential campaign. But my view is that Macron needs to carry on more or less doing what he's done pretty successfully over the last few weeks, and he ought normally to get onto that first round. And if he does, to go into the second round. And if he gets to the second round, at the moment, he's looking in a very powerful position, of course, against Marine Le Pen, although some polls are narrowing somewhat on that second round.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Cole, thank you very much for joining us on World in Focus today.
Thank you very much.
This is World in Focus. I'm Carolyn Scott, and it is 30 minutes past the hour. It's not the first time, and unlikely to be the last time, that a late-night tweet from the US President Donald Trump has caused serious diplomatic head-scratching among America's allies. But recent online claims by the US leader that British intelligence had placed him under surveillance have caused one former British ambassador to warn that Trump's comments are damaging the intelligence relationship between the two countries. For more, Mark Hurst has this report.
US President Donald Trump's late-night Twitter feeds have caused amusement for his followers, but widespread alarm for a growing number of diplomatic allies, including the UK. Last week, the US President claimed GCHQ, Britain's secret surveillance centre, had been bugging his offices. This prompted a strong and unprecedented rebuttal from the British Security and Intelligence Service, rubbishing the claim. But what damage is Trump's Twitter rhetoric doing to the much-vaunted UK-US special relationship, and will it have a practical impact on the daily work of British and American intelligence services? Well, earlier I spoke to Peter Gill, honorary visiting fellow in politics and international relations at the University of Leicester, and I put those points to him. The former British ambassador to the US, Sir Peter Westmacott, has warned that the White House is playing a dangerous game in suggesting President Trump was placed under surveillance by GCHQ. But in practical terms, what, if any, damage will President Trump's comments do to the day-to-day relations US and UK intelligence services have?
I would have thought probably very little, to be honest. The services, you know, so NSA in US and GCHQ in the UK, who are equivalent in terms of carrying out the signals and communications intelligence. I mean, they have a very long-standing and very professional relationship. And so I think what Trump has said and what Spicer repeated in the press conference, I think will have rather little impact on their day-to-day relations. I mean, to be honest, I suspect that the people at the NSA are somewhat embarrassed about the antics of their new formal boss, their new commander-in-chief, and I suspect the people in GCHQ have some sympathy for their position, you know, because clearly the guy, Trump, this is, I mean, he just has no understanding of what on earth, how this business is conducted.
Isn't the real concern being expressed here by former career diplomats about President Trump's reliance on Twitter diplomacy, bypassing the conventional media and conventional diplomatic channels and appealing directly to his core vote?
Well, yes, I think that's part of it. I mean, clearly, his sort of personal behaviour as president is totally out with normal diplomatic channels, and this will be a concern to diplomats. I think it's interesting that in this particular case of this, furore around his allegation that he was under surveillance on the orders of Obama. I mean, immediately, as I understand it from the press in the UK, the National Security Advisor and head of the NSA spoke with their counterparts in the UK, assuring them that this allegation would not be repeated. Now, I think the Brits would have quite liked an apology, but anyway, but they got that. So I think it is this feeling that the guy is simply ignoring the conventional channels, which of course will upset diplomats, but I suppose the worry for the rest of us should be that while they may be frustrating and sometimes slow, they have stood the test of time and tend perhaps to be rather more reliable than somebody sending out Twitter feeds at 5 a.m.
The US presidential campaign threw up a lot of allegations on both sides, but there were thinly veiled warnings that Donald Trump may undermine US national interests and in turn those of America's allies. Would it not, therefore, be prudent for the intelligence services of both the US and UK to monitor any potential risk posed by presidential candidates who may threaten that national interest or security?
This gets to the heart of the problem, I guess, and is a very, very difficult subject because, as we know, all intelligence services, whether in the US or the UK or Russia or Germany or anywhere, I mean, they all run counterintelligence services as well. Those counterintelligence services are certainly aimed, one of the things they do is to try and ensure that heads of government, heads of state are not put in a position of being compromised or, you know, available for blackmail by foreign powers. I mean, certainly they all do that. So therefore, and I suppose this is the one sort of plausible aspect of Trump's claim about Obama, which is, you know, if the intelligence chiefs in the U.S. perceived that he was a threat to national U.S. national security, national interest, why wouldn't they have put him under surveillance? Well, the answer to that is that the procedures for doing so are extremely thorough now. This is post-Watergate, 1974, 75, and of course there was political misuse and abuse of intelligence in the 1950s, 60s, 1970s. Since the reforms of that period, these things have been tightened up a great deal. So from what I understand about the way these things work, say in the US, even if Obama sat there one day and said, well, I think we should put this man Trump under surveillance, you know, the number of people who would be required to implement that, most of them would say, well, we won't do that because it's illegal. And even if they did, you could guarantee there would be a leak and the thing would have been all over the New York Times and Washington Post. I mean, that's the way things are in Washington, D.C. It's a very leaky city. No president could carry out that kind of thing and hope to keep it secret.
We often hear talk of the UK's special relationship with the US, but the special relationship is also something many of America's other allies also openly flaunt and promote. What is so unique and precious about the joint intelligence relationship that the UK has with the US, and how is it different from that the US shares with, say, Israel?
The so-called special relationship is probably less special now than it used to be in many respects, but the intelligence relationship goes back to the First World War, but certainly goes back to the Second World War. And immediately after the Second World War and the beginning of the Cold War between the West and the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, the so-called UQSA, which stands for UK-USA, involves the United Kingdom, the United States, Australia, New Zealand and Canada in a pact to share intelligence. And this was based around their worldwide coverage for signals intelligence. And this was the origin of this really important alliance. Now, this is still current today, but what has happened, particularly since 9/11, is a growth of similar arrangements with many other countries. So there's a similar arrangement, let's say, in Europe. There's another similar arrangement involving countries involving overseeing areas in the Middle East and so on. So in that sense, it's not as special as it used to be. But I think it's fair to say that the amount of intelligence sharing between the UK and the US is still probably greater than between, say, the US and France or US and Germany, or, to take your example, US and Israel. I mean, as far as Israel is concerned, of course, there are ongoing sensitivities because of occasional outbreaks of spying by Israelis in the US. And so there is some hesitation there.
Sir Peter Westmacott is claiming President Trump is gratuitously damaging the relationship between the two countries. But is any likely breakdown in trust going to be felt harder in London or Washington as a result of President Trump's comments? And who stands more to lose?
As I said before, I don't think we should get so worried about the formal intelligence relationship because I don't think that is being damaged. There's diplomatic embarrassment in both in Washington and in London about this stuff. There's diplomatic embarrassment in Downing Street where people have to kind of put up with this stuff coming out of the White House currently, or coming out of Trump anyway. So there's diplomatic embarrassment. There's some minor interruptions, I guess, and there will be some hesitations on, say, the British part, perhaps providing some intelligence to the US unless they feel very confident that there is no chance that this stuff is going to get anywhere near the president. You know, and I think probably people in the NSA will try and reassure them of that, because clearly the last thing they want is, delicate information going there, which, let's say, might then be used by Trump or one of his colleagues or a member of his family, which might be used in circumstances that would be highly embarrassing, might be used for personal business gain, and so on. So there will be some hesitation, but the fundamental intelligence relationship around issues of security and terrorism and so on, that won't be damaged by Trump.
Professor Gill, many thanks for joining us. Professor Peter Gill there, Honorary Visiting Fellow in Politics and International Relations at the University of Leicester. Mark Hurst, World in Focus.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, the Washington-based OAS, or Organisation of American States, has never been on the best terms with Venezuela's socialist administration. But how seriously should the crisis-stricken South American country take the latest swipe? That being a call from the head of the OAS to suspend Venezuela completely. We'll have more in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case. Simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back to World in Focus. Still to come on today's programme, the Washington-based OAS, or Organisation of American States, has never been on the best terms with Venezuela's socialist administration. But how seriously should the crisis-stricken South American country take the latest swipe? That being a call from the head of the OAS to suspend Venezuela completely. Free trade talks between the European Union and the US are in a deep freeze, the EU Trade Commissioner Cecilia Malmström said last night in Toronto. So what does the future hold for the controversial trade and investment partnership? And we've brought you some ridiculous stories in the past about obscene amounts of money spent on food, and we've got another one for you at the end of the show. The Organisation of American States, or OAS, last week called for the suspension of Venezuela in a detailed report from its head, Luis Almagro, a man whom Venezuela's foreign minister has called a, quote, sad evildoer. But given the fact that the OAS and Venezuela's socialist government have rarely seen eye to eye in the past, just how significant is this development? Jack Foster has more.
It's exactly a week now since the Secretary-General of the OAS, that's the Organisation of American States, released a 75-page report calling for the suspension of Venezuela amidst accusations of human rights abuses and a disregard for the democratic process. Luis Almagro wrote in the opening paragraphs of his report, quote, "The facts have become clear. Venezuela is in violation of every article in the Inter-American Democratic Charter. Democracy and human rights are values that must be above politics, and the task before us is to support Venezuela and restore the rights of the people," end quote. His calls fall largely in line with a growing international consensus towards the Nicolas Maduro administration in Caracas, which views with scepticism the way in which that government has attempted to weather a worsening economic crisis plagued with spiraling currency inflation, and how it's responded to calls for a recall referendum amidst plummeting approval ratings for President Maduro. Opponents also argue that the incumbent administration holds a number of so-called political prisoners and is stifling the democratic process. This, though, is not the first time, of course, that the OAS has been at loggerheads with the administration in Caracas. Based in Washington, D.C., many in Venezuela, particularly on the political left, already view the OAS as an organization that's biased towards a US-friendly position. So, unsurprisingly, the government in Venezuela has not reacted well to this news. Joining me on the line now from Santiago in Chile is Juan Nagel, a professor of economics at the University of the Andes. Thank you for speaking with us today, Professor Nagel. Now, firstly, there are obviously problems in Venezuela right now, but how likely would being frozen out of the OAS be to solve those problems? Would it not perhaps be more likely to isolate Maduro's administration further, a tactic which has only really exacerbated these sorts of problems thus far?
Well, I think that this is a diplomatic pressure measure that is unlikely to yield results in terms of improved governability and access to elections. It would put pressure on Maduro's allies in the hemisphere to try and get him to change his ways a bit and bring him maybe to a negotiating table. Sadly, it's the only thing that the hemisphere has in terms of pressuring Maduro. There's no significant threat of economic sanctions or anything like that. The fact that Venezuela is a major oil exporter means that there are limited measures that can be taken to pressure him economically. And the OAS can't really pressure him in terms of access to credit and loans and financing that the government desperately needs. So it's more a political pressure and diplomatic pressure. That's sort of the road that they're taking. We'll see if it yields results. There is a precedent, though, that in Peru in the year 2000, the OAS did manage to pressure the Fujimori regime at the time to change its ways, and it actually accomplished the dismissal of the president and the new elections. So there is the hope that it could yield some good results. But
how justified is Nicolas Maduro in saying that this is an aggressive move?
Well, it's certainly aggressive, but it's certainly not unjustified. I mean, everything in the report has a factual basis, from my reading at least. Obviously, the government disagrees. The fact that there are many political prisoners, that the number of political prisoners has been increasing in recent months, the fact that elections have basically been suspended in the country, the fact that the National Assembly has basically been stripped of all of its powers, all of these are undisputed facts, really, unless the government really wants to spin it some other way. So the report is actually very well based, very well documented, and it hasn't been something that came about suddenly or abruptly. This has been in the books for months, and the government has known about this, and it actually hasn't done anything to prevent this sort of move from happening. Whether or not the OAS will actually likely vote to apply the democratic charter is still to be seen. I mean, there's a great reticence in the hemisphere to intervening in its neighbors' affairs, and I just heard the Peruvian government saying that, well, maybe we don't have the votes to really apply the democratic charter here. But it's certainly increasing the pressure on the Maduro administration.
Lastly, the OAS is obviously headquartered in Washington, D.C. With that in mind, how much of these developments might we relate to a shifting policy in the U.S. under the Trump administration?
Well, it remains to be seen. Obviously, the credibility of the OAS in the hemisphere has always been called into question by the fact that the U.S. plays such a large role in the organization and by the fact that, you know, it's headquartered in Washington. That has triggered movements by regional governments to create regional bodies without the U.S. involvement, but these have proven to be ineffective. So whether or not the Trump administration is going to actually use the OAS to implement a more aggressive agenda towards Venezuela, it remains to be seen. The signs we've seen so far from the Trump administration is that, yes, they're willing to go more deeply into the issue and move more aggressively particularly towards the heads of the administration and the more notorious figureheads that the government has. But then again, this is a very young administration with shifting interests and shifting, it's still feeling its way in the hemisphere in terms of building alliances and whatnot. So it remains to be seen. It'll be interesting to see how they play this card.
Well, Juan Nagel, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thanks a lot.
Juan Nagel there, Professor of Economics at the University of the Andes, and he was speaking to us there about the call from the OAS head last week to suspend Venezuela. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
This is World in Focus. It's 47 minutes past the hour. The European Trade Commissioner, Cecilia Malmström, has said that free trade talks with the US are in a deep freeze and that the Trump administration is sending worrying signals on trade, adding that erecting barriers to global trade threatens to kill jobs. It's a further sign of the probable demise of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, known as TTIP, which the EU and the US have been negotiating for over 5 years and should have been one of the main legacies of the Obama era. TTIP was designed in part to cut red tape and regulatory barriers for big businesses, boosting trade between the EU and the US. But it came under fire in part due to the top-secret nature of negotiations occurring behind closed doors and allowing governments to be sued by corporations in private courts. Sputnik's man in London, Jim Ensom, joins me on the line. Now, Jim, just why was Barack Obama so keen on this deal?
He was absolutely behind the idea of TTIP in creating what would be the biggest trade deal in the world. He wanted to open up the entire US market to the entire EU market, and that would have been absolutely brilliant in his books. And he made that a point of his presidency. And he really did, in his second term of office, push and push and push for the negotiations to be speeded up. He wanted, before he left office, to be able to sign the TTIP agreement. And it's a sign of the importance of it, because, as you know, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is a massive supporter of TTIP. They formed, while he was in power, a unique bond between the German Chancellor and the US President. And indeed, it was quite noticeable that the last thing he did on his last trip to Europe was actually go to Germany. He'd been on a rally in favor of TTIP in Hanover, but on his last journey to Europe, his last thing that he did was to have a meal with Angela Merkel. And I would imagine that there was a sense of disappointment in that meal, because he hadn't managed to get what his legacy should have been, which the TTIP deal done, but Merkel promised him that she would push it and keep pushing, even though he was out of office.
Mm. And of course, at the time, his counterpart in the UK, David Cameron, was massively behind TTIP as well prior to the Brexit vote.
Exactly. And of course, that's what's quite significant about, the latest comments, in that obviously Obama has gone, and he was a great exponent of it. So has Cameron gone. And there is now, of course, a sense of anti-EU sentiment and rising anti-TTIP sentiment, not helped by Trump's latest comments.
Mm-hmm. And the anti-TTIP sentiment, it wasn't just from Eurosceptics. There was a lot of opposition to it across the board from the predominantly left-wing groups as well. Why was there so much opposition to TTIP?
It's quite simple. In America, there are regulatory systems over the food you can eat, children's food, food colorants, medicines, tolerances in metal manufacture, for instance. Every industry, if you make something, Carolyn, you have to have it regulated. And if you take, say, in the US, in their chicken production, they are allowed to wash their chickens, their carcasses, in chlorinated water. Now, that's because of the Food and Drink Drug Administration over there allows that to happen. In the EU, they don't. And the problem is, if you want to have a trade agreement, you've both got to agree common regulatory conditions. So that example I've just given you of the chicken, that is true of many, many other things. There were environmental issues. There were issues over emissions, for instance, over food colorants and all those sort of things. And there, one of the problems is, if the two can't agree and country A in the US is prohibited from selling its goods in country B in the EU, they can then push that to a dispute resolution system, because someone has got to arbitrate, you see. And in the event that they win, then they can win compensation from the country that's not allowing them for their goods to be sold. It's called the Investor State Dispute Settlement System, ISDS. And many were very much against that, because they said, hang on a minute, this is a tribunal that is entirely a commercial tribunal that's outside of any judiciary in any of the EU member states. And they were saying, come on, this is just a way that big businesses are going to force themselves through, water down our regulatory conditions, and take the dispute outside of our court systems. And that's why there was rising opposition throughout Europe.
Mm-hmm. And that when we saw the similar trade deal between Canada and the US, we saw Canada become one of the most sued governments in the world for things such as a moratorium on fracking. And there was a lot of fears in the UK that it could be a forced privatisation of the health system, because then a company, if I've got my facts right, could sue the British government if they don't allow a company to tender for services within the NHS.
Absolutely spot on, because basically under the Trade and Services Agreement or a similar type of thing under TTIP, if a country is part of the trade deal, they have to open up tenders for services, etc., to the other members of that trade pact. And as you say, quite rightly, they were saying it's a backdoor way for big businesses in America to take over parts of Britain's National Health Service. And this is true of many, many other things. And that was a real stumbling block for a lot of people.
Mm. And despite all of this opposition, it did seem like there was still a chance for TTIP until the election of Donald Trump. So what exactly has Donald Trump done to kill this deal?
Well, he made it quite clear that he doesn't like multilateral trade deals. He'd rather do a deal one-to-one with a country, what's known as a bilateral trade deal. He immediately said in the run-up to the election that he was going to take another look at NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Alliance, and he was going to take a look at that. He basically poo-pooed TTIP and said that that was going to go on hold. And we very, very quickly realized that if he was going to go against NAFTA, and he said, we're going to put America first, he says, multilateral trade deals don't work for America first. And it means that other countries can access American markets and lose American jobs, because basically he's gone very, very protectionist. And if you're a protectionist, you are not in for big trade deals, which the EU is going for, because you have to open up your markets and they have to open up their markets. And he is a protectionist by character. And he made it quite clear that if he was going to have a look at NAFTA, the other one, he was definitely going to have a look at his TTIP. Well, he hasn't sort of necessarily made great guns on it, but he has decried TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as well as the TTIP in speeches. So the reality is what he said is he's absolutely put the thing on ice. Mm-hmm. And everyone now is wandering around in Brussels, shrugging their shoulders, saying, what do we do now?
Mm-hmm. So what do they do now? Where does this leave the European Union?
Well, if the commissioner has basically admitted it, which he has in that speech in Toronto last night, that it's, dead in the water, as it were, then, to be honest with you, there's not a lot they can do. I think next move is Donald Trump to actually come out and say formally that the talks will end. I mean, that's one option. But I think he's got to get his team together before he does that. At the moment, it's in total limbo. The EU, I think, knows it's in limbo. The talks can't continue. The politicians are just sitting back waiting for something to happen. And I've no doubt that, in fact, the talks will probably come to absolutely nothing. And the EU will have to look elsewhere for its trade deal. As it is, the EU is going to have to rethink its whole trade organisation because of Brexit and other pressures on it as well. So basically the whole thing's going to go into the great black hole of Brussels, and I don't think it's going to emerge the other end.
Mm. Of course, TTIP was used by the campaigners during the EU referendum in the UK. Those who were campaigning to leave the EU said that this would secure us from being part of the TTIP deal, though those who were campaigning to stay in the EU said that actually if we leave, we're likely to have our government strike a deal with the US that is like TTIP, just between the UK and the US. Now, is there still a chance that any trade deal with the US might bring in this kind of ISDS system with it?
Well, I think what I imagine is going to happen is obviously the Brits have been heavily involved in the negotiations, which have been going on since 2011. And I think it could be used as a blueprint for a bilateral deal between the UK and the US. Mm. Now, the question of dispute resolution will never go away. But the good news is Britain has been trading with the US without a trade deal for donkey's years. They have a very, very close relationship. Disputes, when they arise, are normally sorted out between the trade ministries of the two countries. They come to a diplomatic and a pragmatic solution to it. So I think it could be easier to set up a UK-US trade deal modelled on currently where we are, and they could. It's going to be a lot easier to sort out the dispute resettlement system between two countries than between 28 countries plus the US. So I think it's going to be a lot easier for whoever finally signs this trade deal, if it goes ahead between the UK and the US based on TTIP, it's going to be a lot easier for the President of the US and the Prime Minister of Britain to actually come to us, see a way forward to actually alleviate it.
Well, Jim Ensom, thank you very much. And finally, have you ever found yourself with a spare $25,000 and thought, if only I could spend it all on a taco? No, well, neither have I. But if anyone listening has such a desire, you can now blow 25 grand on a taco at the luxurious Grand Villas Los Cabos Resort. And what on earth makes this taco so expensive? Well, the ingredients, Almaz Beluga Caviar, Kobe Beef, Black Truffled Brie and Langoustines, are held together in a gold flake-embedded tortilla. And just to add a few more dollars to the cost, it's topped with exclusive tequila Le .925, Morita chili peppers and Chivet coffee. Chivet coffee, of course, is that defecated by Asian Catholic creatures who've been fed coffee cherries. Sounds delightful, but I can think of many other things I'd buy if I had $25,000. And that's all we have time for in this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and just a moment we hand over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartmann Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.